we're putting tens of thousands over the years of native plants out into the Chattanooga landscape. Why is that important? Well, as we're talking about restoring this ecological balance, it can't all be on protected land. We have 317 acres. The Park Service has a couple thousand acres. But this metro area with over a million people, depending on how kind of wide you go, is millions of acres.
Yeah.
So what we really need, and we need homeowners like yourself to plant native plants and create native habitats.
Welcome back to the Camp House Podcast and our conversation with Mark McKnight. Mark is the executive director of the Reflection Writing Arboretum and Nature Center. And today, in the second half of our discussion on conservation, we talk about the efforts to help repopulate the red wolves of the South and what you can do, what each one of us can do to protect and preserve our local ecosystem. This is the Camp House Podcast, and I'm your host, Matt Busby.
Okay, so bad farming at the turn of the century, and then the Chambliss family buys the land and makes it a beautiful arboretum. And then you have the nature center that comes in. And then over time, certain things were added, like the Red Wolf Species Survival Plan.
Okay, yeah.
We have 5 endangered red wolves. We're about to have 6 in a captive breeding program. The red wolf was hunted to extinction in the United States, mostly because we have a cultural bias against wolves. I mean, the big bad wolf, all these stories, our European tradition predisposes us to think of wolves as bad. And unfortunately, we won and we basically killed them all. So there was an unprecedented action that scientists took, and I can't remember, I think this was 70s, but it was clear that the red wolf was going to go extinct. And so they went out onto the landscape into the last remaining range in Louisiana, and they captured all of them. And out of 100 something that they captured, there were only 14, I think, genetically pure red wolves, because they were getting so desperate they actually started mating with coyotes, and so there was this weird crossbreeding that was happening. So they took the genetically pure red wolves and put them into a breeding program, and operators like us have them and breed them. And
so how many of those operators are there around the country?
There are over 40. Okay. It's about 40. I think it's about 45 right now.
And how much success have you guys had? Have you seen with this?
Well, I mean, the good news is it works. You can breed wolves in captivity. We've had a few litters of pups here in Chattanooga. Like I said, we have a breeding pair that we've been assigned for this year. So my hope is in spring we'll be talking about the new pups. The unfortunate side is the wild release. I mean, the point of this is not to just have wolves that we can all look at in zoos. That's not all that interesting. The point is to get them back in the landscape and to restore the natural order. And there was a wild release in North Carolina on the Albemarle Peninsula, where there are a couple million acres there that are fairly remote and, well, really remote. If you've ever driven out there. And they released wolves into the wild and saw that population grow and become stable. Unfortunately, again, humans get in the way and politics get in the way. And the landowners, I think, never really got behind the program. And there's a perception, it's a misperception, that red wolves are going to interfere with your livestock. Coyotes are actually much more likely to take any livestock that we want to make money off of. Red wolves actually prefer smaller animals. And so what ends up happening is coyotes are invasive. They're not supposed to be. I mean, they came
everywhere
from out west. And they basically just filled the void that was created by the American red wolf not being on the landscape. And so when coyotes finally made it to North Carolina, they started being a real nuisance with farmers. And so farmers wanted to be able to hunt coyote. Problem is, if you allow coyote hunting, especially at night, you really can't tell the difference behind a scope. Mm. I mean, even a biologist that studies red wolf would have a really hard time just on sight trying to figure out what's what. So you couldn't really blame the farmers if they shot wolves, which they did. And that was actually not even illegal. Mm. So there was not a consequence to it. So there wasn't really an incentive to figure it out. So they kind of went back and forth, and North Carolina outlawed nighttime hunting, and then they kind of went back, and they went back and forth. And then we end up with the current administration, and this, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did a study and presented some new management guidelines. Those management guidelines are going to reduce this protected area. So right now, at least in the two-ish million acres, it's at least illegal to kill a red wolf on purpose. So they have some amount of protection. But they're going to reduce that protected area to a very, very small couple hundred thousand acres. Now, the wolves don't know. They're across the entire landscape. So essentially, it's just consigned them to extinction again in the wild.
So is the red wolf habitat is that mainly in the southeast?
Yeah, they like swampy lowland areas. So they would have been throughout, I don't know how far north they would have gone, but all the Atlantic states.
Yeah, most of the river basins.
Into here, and they would be, you know, you think about where they are right now in our property and that whole, that swamp land, they would have been naturally through that area. It would have led to far less deer than we have now. The deer population is out of control because they have no predators anymore.
Right.
They basically just have disease in their own competition. And then there's just it's called a trophic cascade, but there's just the entire landscape is different. Mm. The one major success that's come out of this American Red Wolf reintroduction is that this model of captive breeding and then reintroduction was copied and then used successfully for the wolves in Yellowstone.
Okay.
And so they released the native wolves back into the Yellowstone caldera, and they have taken off and thrived. And it has changed everything all the way down to the river, the temperature of the river, the direction of the river.
Huh.
So the Yellowstone River has been impacted by just reintroducing this apex predator. So it's fascinating to see. There's a great documentary about it. And
you know what it's called?
I don't off the top of my head. But I know it's on I think I watched it on Netflix.
Okay.
We'll have to put that in the show notes.
Yeah. That's why I want to figure out the name. I'll find it and put it in the show notes.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
So I want to, hopefully we can make that movie about Chattanooga someday. If we can get the wolves back on the landscape.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you know, part of what you're really interested in taking this position is really building on the legacy of innovation and conservation that Mr. Chambliss really started in this area and this community. And I would hope that you're looking to build on that. So I think my question for you is, you know, what is the future of reflection writing and really even talk about some of the stuff you've implemented over the last year.
Sure. Well, first, let's go back to the name. It's Reflection Writing, Arboretum and Nature Center. I think there's a lot in there. I'm actually very, very tired because I got in at about 1 o'clock this morning from McAllen, Texas.
Okay.
Where I was attending the ANCA is what it's called, the Association of Nature Center Administrators annual summit. And it was at the World Birding Center down there. And I was really fortunate to spend a week with my peers running all kinds of different nature centers, some of them public, on state park land or in national parks.
Do you have any, how many of these are there around the country? Like how many different?
1,400 nature centers.
Okay.
And there were 170 nature center administrators at this conference. And so, you know, a decent cross section of many of them private, like we are, private nonprofits, just a huge variety. some of them with gigantic budgets that I can't even imagine, and some of them even smaller than us. And I think what I came away from there, we're also members. Like, let me go back. We're also, so Arboretum is one of the key words in our name. We are a level 4 Arboretum, which is the highest achievable level. We have something like 130 trees labeled, and then
from all over the place,
many like, more than that, of shrubs and perennials and things like that. And then we have a native plant nursery. I'm excited to say we just got through our plant sale this weekend.
My wife bought a few. She was there. She loved it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to say that that horticulture operation is now on par from a financial perspective with our education
department. Oh, that's incredible.
Department. So yeah. we're putting tens of thousands over the years of native plants out into the Chattanooga landscape. Why is that important? Well, as we're talking about restoring this ecological balance, it can't all be on protected land. We have 317 acres. The Park Service has a couple thousand acres. But this metro area with over a million people, depending on how kind of wide you go, is millions of acres.
Yeah.
And so what we really need, and we need homeowners like yourself to plant native plants and create native habitats. Doug Talamy wrote this book, Dr. Doug Talamy wrote this book called Bringing Nature Home. And he was actually the keynote speaker at the ANCA conference. And he was here in Chattanooga recently at the Wild Ones symposium. I actually didn't go to see him that event because I knew I was going to see him the next week in Texas. But he does this fascinating presentation where he did a scientific study in his own backyard where he took a 12 by 12 foot section around a tree, and he did a couple of native trees in his yard, and then he did a couple of non-native trees in his neighbor's yard and looked at the biodiversity and what just a simple choice like that in your landscape may, what kind of effect that has on the environment. And he found hundreds of caterpillars that were maintained by the native trees. And I think they found one caterpillar on the Bartlett pear. Because it's not native,
all of
these species co-evolved in a way that they depend on each other.
Yeah.
And that one caterpillar was probably just lost.
he was having a bad day.
And, okay, well, who cares about caterpillars, right? Well, caterpillars are what eats caterpillars.
Birds. Yeah.
So then they studied the birds, and they watched how many caterpillars it takes to keep a single bird alive, and it ends up being thousands of caterpillars to be able to actually to allow one pair of birds to reproduce. You need thousands of caterpillars. So if you don't have native trees, you don't have caterpillars, you don't have birds. So it's kind of all the way full circle back to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, where we're looking around. If you walk into a kind of typical golf course community where people have selected plants that on whatever basis they select plants, but not thinking about what's native, you're not going to have any birds. You're not going to have an ecosystem.
Yeah.
And we're part of the migration of a lot of different really beautiful and interesting birds. And if they don't have anywhere to go, they don't live.
Yeah.
so what we envision it all kind of, the core is education. The core is conservation through education. Mm-hmm. If we can spark people, not just kids, people, all people, to get interested and to start looking around and asking questions about their environment. And then we can draw them along that path towards really understanding how an ecosystem works. Then we can sell them the plants.
We can
give them the education, teach them how to plant what and where. A single butterfly requires two different types of plants. You need the host plant that the caterpillar actually lives on, but then you also need the plant for nectar that the butterfly is going to eat. That's not the same plant.
Huh.
Pipevine swallowtail, which is Batis phylonor, is a really beautiful species that we have here, and it the caterpillars eat pipe vine.
Okay.
Sometimes called Dutchman's pipe, but if you go right outside my office, there's a pipe vine growing in this beautiful garden, and it's our pollinator garden. And so that's the host plant. And if you don't know to plant that, you're not going to have this butterfly.
And then what does the butterfly actually eat?
Well, the butterfly is not as selective, but, okay. but it feeds on flowers,
right.
You know, nectar. And I'm not sure exactly which flowers, but it's so fascinating when you start unraveling the complex interactions that are required. It's not, this isn't optional. It isn't like you can have some of the things and not the other things. You have extinction if you don't have the right habitat.
Right. If you don't have the right mix of plants.
And we're living through the sixth great extinction. We have evidence of five massive extinctions in the past through fossil records. And all that's just kind of being pieced together over the years. Most of it was, we now think, I guess you could say, in the way that scientific knowing happens. Those were all huge changes in the environment that right. happened very quickly. So an asteroid, for example, hit the Yucatan Peninsula and caused a massive die-off.
Right.
That's when we lost the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So that was a really controversial idea when scientists first started kind of piecing together the evidence that they were collecting. They're like, is this possible? And a couple of people put this idea out, and they actually died still kind of, I wouldn't say laughingstock, but like people thought they were crazy. Like this isn't a thing that could happen. But it's now more or less proven that that's what happened. Our current, they call this the Anthropocene, but we're in an era of a world of our own making.
Yeah.
And we can choose, we have the power to choose to make it a functional ecosystem or to continue to kill off essentially every species.
Everybody so, but us, yeah.
Yeah.
And then
we go.
Yeah.
I mean, we're part of this.
The food supply, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, not to be overly dramatic, but I think as you start learning about biodiversity, first off, it's just beautiful and fascinating. We have a iNaturalist project. It's you go and observe species, so you can take pictures, upload it. One, it helps you identify if you don't know what it is. There's an AI algorithm that okay. will analyze the photo and give you really likely suggestions
for plants
of
or for animals.
Everything.
Okay. Nice.
Everything. And it's I will say it's better at the easy things. You know,
yeah.
you think about birds, like it's a red bird. It's probably a cardinal. So the algorithm has to be trained, and it's definitely better at that stuff than it is at grasses are really hard.
Right.
Because it's just very hard to take a picture that's worth.
What about vines?
Decent at vines.
Because my wife and I are about to move into a new house, and I swear to you, there's six kinds of vines growing around this house.
Yeah.
And my fear is that 90% of it's poison ivy. but but yeah, that'll be fun to download that and figure
yeah,
it
absolutely.
Out.
Yeah, absolutely. Go. And you can, you know, there's some tips. Like you can go take, you want to take, you want to fill the frame with the thing that you're trying to identify.
Okay.
So go take a picture of kind of one leaf, you know. And then I usually do, it helps. So here's the other thing too. It's not all about the algorithm. It's about the community. So you, once you upload this stuff, you can say, I don't know what it is. You can actually type in vine. You can go as far up or down the taxonomic tree that you kind of understand.
Right.
You can just say it's plant.
Yeah.
You know? And then somebody else can come in. I can, like if you do this at Reflection Writing, I'll actually get a notification and see that you've observed something. And so I'll jump in and help. And so I'll say, oh, well, yeah, that's... I don't know. It's pipe vine, or
okay.
it's and maybe I don't know exactly what it is, but I'll say, well, it's a vine, and so you're kind of working your way down,
it's figuring
and
it out.
And the
yeah.
community will come in and do it. And the other thing that's really cool about it is that it's all open data for the scientific community. So people studying biodiversity can actually go and look and see where things are occurring.
Well, especially like tracking invasive species too, as well. Like
that's one of the uses that's one of the ways that I use it. Actually, we have a big project right now where we're inviting volunteers to go hike our property, especially higher up, and go record the hemlocks that are on our property. Just this year, we have an infestation of the hemlock woolly adelgid, which is a small parasitic insect that has no, again, this is a common theme, but one of them, so there, I'll go all the way back. There are three main threats against biodiversity right now. It's habitat loss because of us. It's invasive species, plants, animals, insects. And then it's climate change.
Okay.
And so we can fix climate change ultimately. I really do believe that we can. We know what to do. So far, we're not doing it, but we can fix it. But we can't, so far, recreate species. When a species goes extinct, it's extinct forever. There may be a scientific advancement where we figure out how to kind of reanimate life and play God, but so far, not possible. So the really urgent issue for us right now is this species extinction. Okay, so with all of that said, one of the key things that we're trying to do is fight invasives and then replant and repopulate with natives. We have an advantage because we actually have a native plant nursery.
So that helps.
We can actually create these plants, and we have the knowledge of how to propagate and create plants. On the invasive side, it just takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of money, a lot of volunteer effort. And so...
Let me ask this one, like, I think a blaring question about invasive species in Chattanooga. Like, how do you get rid of kudzu, right? Like, what are practical steps in actually getting rid of that invasive species?
Well, I think first you have to start with the realization that it didn't get to the point where it is today overnight.
Yeah.
And that it's not going to be cheap. So it's, if you think about money, I mean, money is a proxy for time. So it's going to take you one or the other or both. You can hire somebody to come in and do it, and we've done some of that. We paid for about 250 hours of a company called IPC, Invasive Plant Control, in Nashville, and we had them come in and just blitz the whole swampy section and around the animals.
Are they literally just pulling it up? Like
they were doing what's called the infestation and the specific species are going to dictate your management efforts. In our case, we had such a extreme infestation. It's the highest level of their classification of infestation. And the type of species that we're dealing with included Chinese privet, things like bush honeysuckle. So bushy things and trees.
Okay. Yeah.
And so the method that we decided to use was called cut stump. So you go in and they have this really nasty looking, it's like a weed whacker, but with these big, nasty metal blades.
Yeah.
And they actually are zapping, and they're just cutting through and letting the bush or tree fall over. And then you're spraying with a concentrated herbicide. So you're spraying the stump. So
right
on
the stump, yeah.
Cut, spray. So when we had them, we were hiring them mostly for their knowledge. They were doing this during the wintertime. So they're going around when there are no leaves and just identifying by the, the naked plant.
Yeah.
That's invasive. That should stay. And so they did that. We wanted them moving as fast as they could, just financially. And so we just had them leave everything. And then we went and we matched that effort and then it ultimately exceeded it with over 250 hours of volunteer time to then take that biomass.
Just pull it out.
And pull it out.
Yeah.
We burned some in place where we could. We took what we couldn't, and we burned it in piles. And then some of it past the burn season is just piled up waiting. And you can actually take it to the city and pay them, and they'll compost. But that's the crazy thing. So you've got to kill the plant, but then you also have to take that, whatever that biomass is, and depending on what type of plant it is, all of that stuff can then
resprout,
invade something else.
Yeah.
So you need to actually destroy the DNA in many cases. So it's a long-term project, and I'd love to get to the place where we're actually leading that conversation and starting to, and we're starting to, but actually convince people to spend the money to get rid of, to actually completely rid the area of some of these infestations so they don't just keep coming back.
Yeah.
And we're, I mean, we're committing to a 100+ year process, especially with the hemlock woolly adelgid, because it doesn't have any predators. You have to actually treat the trees. I mean, we have to inoculate the trees. And the inoculation that we have today only lasts somewhere between 5 to 7 years. So it's going to have to be done every 5 to 7 years unless we figure something else out in the meantime. Wow. And there are scientists trying to figure out how to use beetles that are native to Asia where this pest comes from. But, you know,
there's an unknown.
And they're having a hard time keeping them alive. The irony is, like, if you have a beetle that eats the adelgid, you have to have the adelgid for the beetle to be alive. So it's this, you're kind of creating a new world with a different balance. And that's kind of the place where we find ourselves. So our idea is to get people fascinated with tools like iNaturalist and in our education programs on site. Just kind of get people to fall in love with this beautiful biodiversity.
Right.
And then have them start asking questions about what they can do.
So education is going to be has always been a huge part of the vision of the Arboretum.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a huge part of this going forward. And I love the fact that you guys are doing native plant sales now. Like I said, my wife's really excited about the stuff she bought and the way that's going to look, probably not for another 3 years at her new house. But, you know, what is something else, maybe one other thing that you're really excited about on the horizon for Reflection Writing?
Well, I think stepping up our game in terms of who we can educate and how. Once we get to, and we'll do strategic and master planning, but in my mind, I want to be able to bring more people into Chattanooga to see what we have to offer here and to see the efforts that we're making. And I think that means they need a place to stay.
Mm. Okay.
So there's some interesting thoughts
there.
And I just saw it with the World Birding Center down in Texas. It was originally supposed to be one site, and Texas State Parks had chosen a site, and it was a very competitive process. And then they ended up just kind of getting all the politicians and everybody involved, and they said, "Why World Birding Center doesn't have to be one site."
That's cool.
They ended up with, I think, 9.
Yeah.
And I visited several of them this past week. And on iNaturalist, I haven't even uploaded everything yet, but I'm up over 100 species that I observed.
Wow.
Over this past week. And that was mostly just incidental. You know, I wasn't just walking through the forest doing it all day.
Yeah.
Although I would like to. So I think I can see a time in which Chattanooga is recognized as the hotspot for biodiversity that it is, and that we're actually bringing in people, researchers, educators.
That's something we actually haven't explicitly said on this podcast, but Chattanooga does exist in this really weird section of the country where we actually have probably, from what I understand, what I heard, and you can correct me or affirm this, it is one of the greatest biodiversity. It's some of the greatest biodiversity in the entire country because we're on the edge of the Appalachians. We're getting close to sort of the more tropical section of the country. And so it's this weird mix. It's why allergies are so bad for most people here.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, again, back to the habitat, different habitats have different species that are evolved to live in that habitat. And we have such a diversity of habitat that, we have a crazy, crazy number of different species. And the term that I've heard is underwater rainforest.
Huh.
But specifically, if you go down to a taxon that's really interesting, freshwater fish here in this area are really interesting.
Well, like the Conasauga, right, which is a river about an hour from here, mm-hmm. has some of the greatest diversity of freshwater fish in the entire country.
Yeah, and Citico Creek has the Citico darter endemic. Endemic means it only exists in one place. It's endemic to Citico Creek. There's only that one. You know, if you screw up Citico Creek, that species is gone. There are tons of examples of that, and they're really interesting. The more you dig into, I mean, you could spend several lifetimes kind of studying the biodiversity here in Chattanooga.
Well, Mark, I really want to get you out on this one last question. I like to try and end the podcast with something fun. And I'm very curious, from your time at Roots Rated, what's the one top 10 list that you didn't get to write that you wish you had written?
Interesting. I think the top 10 day trips out of Chattanooga. I think one of the things that's cool about Chattanooga is actually getting out of here.
Yeah. It's so close to everything.
We're so close to so many different things. And I don't know. Maybe we did write that and I didn't see it, but I didn't write it. So
cool. So top 10 day trips outside of Chattanooga. What would have been the number one for you?
Well, I mentioned Citico. I do think Citico Creek is one of the most beautiful places within, it's about a 45-minute drive.
Okay.
And Cherokee National Forest in general is just this beautiful place that you can spend a lot of time in. It's a little closer than the Smokies. I mean, the Smokies are awesome, but it's a little closer than the Smokies.
Cool. Well, Mark, thanks so much for being here, man.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much to Mark McKnight for stopping in and having this conversation on conservation here in Chattanooga. You know, if you have not been to Reflection Writing right now, this weekend, it's just a perfect time to go because fall is in full bloom. We should have peak colors either this weekend or next weekend. So if you're listening to this when this episode comes out, please get outside this weekend and enjoy one of the aspects that makes our community so great, and that is the outdoors and how close everything is. Now, in the show notes of this episode, you'll find a lot of the things that we talked about, including that documentary about the gray wolf reintroduction into Yellowstone and the incredible impact that's had on the entire ecosystem. The other thing is there's a link in there to the iNaturalist app that Mark and I talked about. And ever since my conversation with Mark, I've downloaded that app and it is fantastic. It is the funnest thing to use on hikes with my kids as we discover new species, whether it's plants or bugs, whatever it is. We can take a picture, we can upload it and find out what it is. And right now, I recently moved into a new house. I think I mentioned that on this episode. And so I'm in the process of actually trying to go through my yard before all the leaves are gone and catalog everything that's in the boundary lines of my property. So I know what's out there and I know kind of what it is that I can do to help preserve my local ecosystem, as Mark was talking about. So check that out. iNaturalist. You can look it up in the App Store if you have an iPhone, or there is a link to the show notes of this episode. As always, thank you to the Chattanooga Public Library for allowing me to use their studio to record this episode, and a special thank you to Charles Allison, who helped produce this episode. And thank you to each one of you for always tuning in. If you haven't already done this, I would love for you to subscribe to the podcast, to leave us a rating and a review that will help people find this episode. You know, I'm finding out more and more and more that one of my key listeners are actually people who don't live in Chattanooga yet. And what they're doing is they're going into iTunes and they're actually searching for Chattanooga, trying to find local podcasts just like this one that will give them an idea of what our community is like. And so if you think that this podcast is representative of Chattanooga, of the great things about our city, but also we talk about the challenges of our city, we want to be really honest about that as well. If you have found that to be true, then please go online, leave us a rating or review that says just that, and share this podcast with your friends. Well, again, thank you all for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And again, get out and enjoy the outdoors.